Welcome to ACT Radio, Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh.
Here on ACT, we talk about how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
And we also discuss why a plant-based diet is the healthiest for humans and the best thing one can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about your health, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas.
Coming up on today's show, we continue our conversation with Joyce Tischler, who's the founder and general counsel of the Animal Legal Defense Fund. That's a little later in the show, but first some news.
On January the 10th, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals asked the Outdoor Channel to stop airing the program Deadliest Hunts. And the reason was because the show's host, notorious elephant killer Jeff Rann, owns 777 Ranch, a canned hunting compound in Hondo, Texas, that allows rich trophy hunters to pay to shoot endangered animals. And last year, he broke federal law by illegally selling a trophy hunt to kill an endangered deer. The Endangered Species Act prohibits killing protected animals for sport, making exceptions only in extremely rare circumstances that will directly help the species in the wild. But under its much-criticized pay-to-play scheme, the Fish and Wildlife Service has issued permits in exchange for token donations to phony conservation organizations. The Fish and Wildlife Service recently approved such a permit for 777 Ranch, which sought its sport hunting permit on the basis that it donates 10% of the profits from each animal's death to Conservation Force, a group that lobbies to protect hunters and helps them obtain the permits needed to breed and kill endangered animals. PETA is calling on the Outdoor Channel to cut ties with Jeff Rann and pull Deadliest Hunts from the airways immediately. The Fish and Wildlife Service came under fire in November for using the pay-to-play loophole to reauthorize the import of elephant trophies from Zimbabwe and Zambia. For years, the agency has been using this loophole to allow the exploitation and slaughter of the very animals it's charged with protecting, including at dozens of canned hunting facilities in Texas.
The ability to investigate, document, and publicize corporate agriculture's abuses is imperative both to the well-being of animals across the nation and to our own health and safety. Ag laws seek to gag would-be whistleblowers and undercover activists by punishing them for recording and disseminating footage of what goes on in animal agriculture. Fortunately, the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit became the first federal appellate court to strike down provisions of an ag law, holding that Idaho's ban on recording conditions at factory farms and slaughterhouses violates the First Amendment. This victory for free speech comes as a result of a lawsuit filed in 2014 by a coalition of public interest groups and journalists led by the Animal Legal Defense Fund. The decision states that Idaho's law is staggeringly overbroad and that the purpose of the statute is, in large part, targeted at speech and investigative journalists. The court concluded that Idaho is singling out for suppression one mode of speech, audio and video recordings of agricultural operations, to keep controversy and suspect practices out of the public eye. The Idaho legislature enacted its ag law after an undercover investigation by Mercy for Animals revealed rampant cruelty at an Idaho dairy farm. Drafted by the Idaho Dairymen's Association, the law would have criminalized investigative public interest journalism. The Animal Legal Defense Fund successfully led a coalition to strike down Utah's ag law in 2017 and has litigation pending against ag laws in Iowa and North Carolina. We'll keep you posted on these cases as they develop.
Tribal groups, the Center for Biological Diversity, and other conservation groups ask a federal judge to invalidate a government decision to strip the Yellowstone region's grizzly bears of longstanding endangered species protections. The coalition cited the recent reopening of public comment on the Yellowstone grizzly delisting rule as evidence that the government did not complete its homework before removing important protections for this population of bears and opening the door to recreational trophy hunting of the iconic grizzlies. In particular, the government failed to consider the impacts of its delisting decision on the opportunity for a broader recovery of grizzlies in the lower 48 states. Earth Justice attorney Timothy Presso states that the time for taking public comment and considering all issues surrounding the removal of federal protections for Yellowstone grizzlies was before those protections were removed, not after the decision was finalized. He further states that Yellowstone region's grizzlies deserve better than to be subjected to trophy hunting based on a half-baked government decision. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service finalized the Yellowstone delisting rule in June 2017. But in December, the service reopened public comment on the rule. The service is asking the American people to weigh in on the impact of a recent court ruling that overturned a similar government effort to withdraw federal protections from the Western Great Lakes wolf population without addressing broader recovery of the species. The service is now promising a new review of the Yellowstone grizzly delisting issue by March 31st. Despite reopening the decision for comment, the service left the removal of Yellowstone grizzlies from the endangered species list in effect. That opens the door for Wyoming, Idaho, and Montana to plan for grizzly bear hunting seasons in the Yellowstone region, with Wyoming already taking steps towards developing a hunt that could begin later this year. Noah Greenwald, Endangered Species Director at the Center, said the Trump administration is trying to put a Band-Aid on a gaping hole in its decision to strip protections from Yellowstone's precious bears. Grizzly bears occupy less than 5% of their former range in the lower 48, so they're obviously nowhere near recovered. He also states that attempting to delist the Yellowstone bears and expose them to trophy hunting without considering the grizzlies' poor status overall is ludicrous. To help grizzlies and to learn more, go to biologicaldiversity.org.
Stay with us. Coming up next, we continue our conversation with Joyce Tischler, who co-founded the Animal Legal Defense Fund and served as its executive director for 25 years. With her leadership, the Animal Legal Defense Fund has filed groundbreaking and major impact lawsuits for almost 40 years. Joyce is an internationally recognized speaker and author of numerous publications and has been quoted in the New York Times, Science Magazine, Washington Post, USA Today, Christian Science Monitor, Guardian, and People Magazine. Joyce currently serves as the Animal Legal Defense Fund's general counsel and is affectionately known as the mother of animal law. That's next on Animal Concerns of Texas. Joining us again on ACT Radio is Joyce Tischler, founder and general counsel for the Animal Legal Defense Fund. Great to have you back, Joyce.
Thank you, Tom. Great to be here.
Joyce, can you tell our listeners how you got involved in animal issues?
I was always involved in animal issues. As a child, I brought animals home who I thought were injured or in need of a home. When I was in college, I ran a quasi-legal cat shelter on campus. When I was in law school, I wrote one of the earliest law review articles on animal law and animal rights. It's always been there. It's always followed everything else I've done. So it was natural and organic for me to form an organization that would work on litigation to protect animals. That combined law with my passion for animals and started in 1979, and it's grown enormously. That's what I'm really proud of, to be honest, and really happy about and grateful for, because it seemed like a good idea at the time, but it could have fallen flat, and I could still be the only one doing it. That would be sad.
Well, you know, there's so many universities now teaching animal law, whereas, 30, 40 years ago, there was nothing.
And it's exciting. And now I go to law schools, and law students will come up to me and say, I'm going to law school to practice animal law. And I'm blown away every time one of them says that. Today we have, our organization was started with just me as an employee, now has close to 50, including one of our favorite employees, Tom Linney, who is building our pro bono department in a wonderful way. We've now got so many pro bono attorneys. Pro bono means for free, attorneys in large firms and small who are doing free work for us, which enables us to do so much more than we could have otherwise done. The field has just absolutely blossomed.
Well, Joyce, I think that's the beauty of the animal law program that the Animal Legal Defense Fund has run for many years now, is that it's building up all these law students around the country to go out. And a lot of these attorneys don't just end up working for ALDF. They end up working for lots of other great animal protection organizations in the U.S. and even outside the U.S., and then, many of them go on to big law firms, and now they're partners, or they're going to be one day in the legislature, or they're going to be judges, and they got exposed to animal law as a result of ALDF's work and professors around the country who are teaching it, and really changing the culture of the legal system and expanding what pro bono means. And one other way to do it is to help animals. So it's a big testament to what ALDF does and working with young attorneys and old attorneys too, to get them involved in a way that they can merge their profession with their passion.
But oftentimes what we hear from these attorneys is, I haven't had this much fun in years. The cases that we bring them tend to be both intellectually stimulating, because when you're creating new law, that's intellectually stimulating, and also they can care deeply about it. And so really we find once a lot of these lawyers do take these cases, they keep coming back for more. So it's wonderful. It's symbiotic. They help us, we help them, and we all work together to help the animals, which is the goal.
How do you guys help them? What do they get out of it?
One of the things they get out of it is that they can assign their younger associates to these cases with oversight from partners. Now, the young associates in really big firms, you know, basically sit in their offices writing pleadings for the first several years, but we might actually get them into a courtroom with our case. So they're going to get a lot of great experience litigating a case.
Their current practice, maybe it's in intellectual property, or it's in consumer protection, or whatever, you know, corporations or business law. We're finding ways, and I think that part of what ALDF does is trying to be creative and using any element of the law in a way that it could benefit animals.
Like the environmental laws, which are important of themselves, but they can also be used to protect animals.
Right, right.
Exactly.
Can you guys give us an example of a recent success story you've had working with a pro bono lawyer and making a gain for animals?
The Endangered Species Act is one of the foundational environmental laws in the United States. And what it does is, when animals are in critical danger, they're listed as either threatened or the upper level, which is endangered, which means that people can't do certain things with them anymore. They have a level of protection that other animals simply don't have. And for years, the Endangered Species Act has been applied to animals, wild animals in the wild. But one of our attorneys came up with the, I think, brilliant idea of, why don't we apply the Endangered Species Act to captive wildlife? And so we found this roadside zoo called Cricket Hollow Animal Park, or Cricket Hollow Zoo, in the state of Iowa.
Sounds
and
scary.
Went after them. Well, yeah, if you see the pictures of this place, it is scary. They had hundreds of animals in horrible, horrible conditions. The only ones we could apply the Endangered Species Act to were those who were already on the list, which was tigers and lemurs. And then actually later on, lions were added to the list. So we were able to sue and succeeded in getting the court to allow the removal of these endangered species. Uh-oh. There's a station again. That's my not-so-endangered dog. And so the court went along with this theory and said, yes, the Endangered Species Act applies to captive animals. And that was wonderful. And we really celebrated that success. But in the background, we also said to ourselves, yeah, well, what about all the other animals who are still there, who are not on the endangered species list? But as a result of what we did, the U.S. Department of Agriculture woke up, this doesn't happen often, and revoked their exhibitor license and issued a $10,000 fine against the owners of this zoo. So we were able ultimately to do a lot more than just get the animals out under the Endangered Species Act. We were able to help the other animals as well. In one place that we were able to impact, there was a bear named Ben, and Ben was in a concrete cage. Small cage, had nothing to do, was chewing at the bars, obviously psychologically impacted, negatively impacted by this. But, you know, we tend not to think about, you know, if people go to a roadside zoo, they look at the animals and say, oh, isn't he cute? Oh, isn't he funny? Not thinking about the fact that this bear is going out of his mind in this horrible environment. And we were able to get Ben out of that horrible place, a place called Jimmy Mac's Ice Cream. I mean, they sold ice cream, and they had this roadside zoo in the backyard. We were able to get Ben out of there and sent to a sanctuary. He can't be sent to the wild because he can no longer survive, but he was sent to a sanctuary where he's got a big hillside, he's got his own pool, he's got trees that he can scratch his claws on, he's got space to roam, and he's got his dignity back, and much better for Ben.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. Great stories when you are able to have success and working around the legal system and being creative and cutting edge and doing these different cases. And I think part of the beauty of ALDF's work is it spans, you know, wildlife. It's captive wildlife. It's companion animals too. And you know, you've rescued a lot of animals over your career. And one of them who I think of is Edgar. And maybe you could tell us a little bit about the epidemic that hoarding is and the case with the Woodleys.
Sure. Hoarding is collecting more animals than you are able to take care of in any kind of a normal, responsible fashion. I mean, that's one definition of hoarding. And there are hoarders all over the United States and all over other places as well. I mean, every city in this country has at least one hoarder. You know, we generally think of that person, usually as women, believe it or not. Hoarders don't give the animals veterinary care. They have them literally in an intensively confined situation. There's dirt and filth everywhere. The animals are suffering, and it's long-term suffering. They're suffering from bite wounds, from diseases that have not been treated, from fleas, from ear infections, from all kinds of physical ailments. So the Woodleys, okay. This case started in around 2004-ish. I was talking to a law professor who's now retired, a guy named Bill Reppy, who's at Duke, and he's a great guy, Bill. And he said he had been researching this law in North Carolina that was highly unusual. It enables anybody, you, me, anybody, to sue to enjoin, which means stop, cruelty. Now, in just about every other state in the country, you can't do that. The only people who can go after cruelty are the prosecutors. In North Carolina, I can sue someone who's being cruel to an animal, and I can get a court to take the animals away and to enjoin the cruelty. And so we started with this law, and we thought, wow, this is an amazing law. We want to try this one out, see what we could do with it, because it had been enforced a few times, or rather used a few times, not enforced, but there wasn't much legal history on it. So we found the Woodleys. We wanted to find a slam dunk case of cruelty because we didn't want to have to convince a judge that cruelty was occurring. You know, we were doing not experimental law, but we were pushing the envelope. We found the Woodleys. The Woodleys were in Sanford, North Carolina. They were a couple in their late 60s, and they had 500 dogs. And these dogs were in horrific condition. They were kept in these sheds, basically, and the sheds were stinky to the point where the dogs couldn't breathe fresh air at all. The fumes from their own urine and waste were overwhelming. Many of the dogs had clouded eyes because of the ammonia from their own urine. Even puppies had clouded eyes. There were broken bones. There were untreated cancers. I mean, these dogs were in horrific condition. So we found our target, and we sued them. And when we did that, the district attorney, we loaned our evidence to the district attorney, and they also brought criminal charges. So this happened at the end of 2004. By 2005, March of 2005, we were able to get the matter to trial, and we won. We were able to convince the judge that, yes, this was cruelty, that, no, you don't leave any of these animals with the Woodleys because they're hoarders. It's like you wouldn't give an alcoholic, oh, you can have one drink per day, right? And with a hoarder, you have to take away all of the animals. So they took away all the animals, and they were also convicted of cruelty. And then was the next step. Okay, we had 300-plus sick, unsocialized dogs. And that was in North Carolina, and we were in California. Now what? And of course, we had asked for costs, and the court denied us any economic recovery.
Oh, that's so terrible.
I know. Well, tell me. but honestly, that's when some real magic started to happen, because people started to step forward and to volunteer. Some people came in, and one man donated. He had a building that had been vacant for 20 years in Sanford. It basically was four walls, a roof, and dirt floors. We took the building. We thanked him. And another man showed up, and he had like a mile of linoleum, put the linoleum down so that we could clean up after the animals. And then PetSmart sent us crates for the dogs to be in, you know, because they were scared, and sent us this fencing so that we could separate the males from the females. And so we basically opened a shelter in Sanford, North Carolina. We put it all together within about a week after the case was over. And as soon as the judge signed the order, we went in and got all of the dogs. We did it in about 8 hours, brought them over to our little shelter, and then people began to come on a daily basis and to clean up after the dogs, to feed them, to change their water, to clean up after them, and to socialize them. Because a lot of these dogs, when they first got there, they were so afraid of human beings, they would defecate. They'd never been touched by a human before. So they had to be socialized so that they could find a new home. And a couple of weeks after the shelter was set up, I went there. There was this one little Boston Terrier, and I knew nothing about Bostons, but he just was so attentive and so calm and gentle, and I ended up falling madly in love with him. You know, you can't help it. You don't plan these things. And I already had two dogs at home. I had no intention of bringing a dog home, but he was one of the oldest ones there. He was about 10 years old, and he had survived that long. And no one else wanted him. So I ended up, a few months later, going back to North Carolina and bringing him back to California with all of his physical issues that he had. He bled from his behind, and he was not potty trained, and he had other issues. And I figured, well, you know, if I could give him a good 2 years, you know, then it's worth it. Then he will at least have had, you know, someone loving him for 2 years. But I was wrapped around his little, I guess dogs don't have fingers, but he was my soulmate, this dog. I named him Edgar, and he lived another 5.5 years, and I just took him everywhere. We did everything together, and we were just so close. He really, I was going through a hard time in my life at that point, and he taught me how to laugh again. So we helped each other.
That's awesome, Joyce. And, you know, you touched on going back to the idea of how hard it is sometimes to get prosecutors to take an animal cruelty case. I imagine you had many stories where you were contacted and people were hoping that you could do something about some matter of animal cruelty, and things sort of, for lack of a better term, out of your jurisdiction. So how did your criminal justice program come to be?
It actually started exactly as you're saying, Tom. People would call us from all over the country and say, I mean, the typical thing they would say is, my neighbor's dog's tied up in the backyard, barking all day, all night, winter and summer. I've called the Humane Society, I've called the Animal Control, I've called the police, no one will do anything, what can you do? And at that point, we were a pretty tiny organization in California, and the answer was, what can we do? Really nothing. And that was very frustrating. I don't like to say no. I don't like to throw my hands up and say there's nothing we can do. And so we kept thinking about it. And after a while, we realized, well, if a prosecutor files charges against a person, then we can do something. We can do legal research in the background, help them out. We can write memos for them. You know, we can be sort of their paralegal in the background, or their pro bono attorney in the background. We can find expert witnesses for them. And so we started off making this offer to prosecutors, and at first they were quite leery of us. But after a while, they started using us, and our work was good. And it was all for free, no strings attached. You know, we would go to them saying, we want to make you look good. We want to help you win this case. What do you need from us? And, you know, sometimes they needed an expert, such as one prosecutor came to us and had a case with turtles who were being sent. They were going to be food turtles. They were going to be made into food. But before then, they were piled on top of each other, and shells were cracking, and they were suffering. But how do you prove to a court that a turtle is suffering? And so, you know, so, but we knew where there were turtle experts, so we would find them a turtle expert. Or a group of cats had died. They were left in cages and they starved to death. How do you prove that they didn't die of disease and died of starvation? We would bring in a forensic veterinarian who could show that there was nothing in their stomachs. So we, over time, grew the program as the requests for assistance grew. Went from legal research to finding experts, to making grants to get those experts to court. Then we started doing trainings of prosecutors and law enforcement. So with each of those things, the program grew into what it is today. It's our criminal justice program. And I'm very proud of that program. I think what we have done with prosecutors has really brought up the profile of animal law in a very respectable way, in a very mainstream way. And we now work closely with the two national associations of prosecutors. And that program does so much wonderful work to protect animals, mainly companion animals, sometimes horses and sometimes farmed animals, but mainly dogs, cats, and others of those ilk, simply by working in the background to help.
I'm slightly biased, having working for the Animal Legal Defense Fund, but I think your work gives us a lot of hope for animal protection in the future, and just hearing about your path and the path of all the colleagues at ALDF, I think, gives us something to really smile about in the new year. And Joyce, I'm wondering if you could tell our listeners where they can go to learn more about ALDF's work.
Yes. Our website is www.aldf.org, and you can find information about our cases as well as a lot of resources for members of the general public, a lot of questions answered about legal rights vis-a-vis landlords or veterinary malpractice or anything. So take a look at our website. I think you'll find lots of great information.
Awesome. Thanks again, Joyce.
Thank you, and keep up the good work.
Yeah, Joyce, it's a real inspiration. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We'd also like to invite you to the Vegetarian Society of El Paso's Winter Dinner and Vegan Buffet. Our featured speaker is none other than our own Greg Lawson. He'll be talking about advertising, propaganda, and lies. This is February 3rd at the Radisson El Paso Airport, and reservations are due on January 30th, so go to vsep.org and make your reservations today.
Also at vsep.org, you'll find a calendar of events which gives you information about upcoming things that the Veg Society of El Paso is doing. If one of your New Year's resolution was to eat healthier, you'll find a lot of information about a plant-based diet at vsep.org.
And if you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACK Radio, you can find them at ktep.org. Just click on the listen button. Until next time, I'm Tom Linney.
I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Liz Walsh for the Earth, the Animals, and a Healthier Humanity. Thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.